Welcome to Mars. Ken Hollings presents a live 12-part series of unscripted reflections on the fantasy of science in the early years of the American century, with electronic sound production by Simon James. Part 8, 1955, Popular Mechanics.
Do you know there are 15,000 babies born in the SAC every month? James Stewart asks in the 1955 movie Strategic Air Command, a tense little domestic drama about national defense initiatives, in which baseball terms, technical jargon, and nuclear strike capabilities are lightly blended in with scenes of family life on an American airbase. There's talk, for example, of a new family of nuclear weapons, and a newborn baby called Hope. But it soon becomes clear that bombing strategies can have a strange effect on the average person's home life. "We've been bombing cities every day and every night all over the US, only people never know it," one of Jimmy Stewart's colleagues excitedly remarks at one point. Strategic Air Command, also known as the SAC or SAC, was by 1955 one of the main players on the desolate test ranges and proving grounds of New Mexico. They were running the bomber flights now, and would be expected to coordinate attack plans in the event of a nuclear showdown with either the Russians or the Chinese. Perhaps when the film first came out, some people in the audience might even have remembered that James Stewart had once been a bomber pilot himself. Seen from above, from the skies, even from space itself, the family becomes this small uniform unit replicating itself constantly across the country. It's a small unit of consumption that creates a future out of small incremental items, little pieces that it can pick up and consume in little bites in the form of comics, magazines, TV shows, cinema tickets, and prepackaged food that's available from their futuristic new kitchens, which actually look like little technical laboratories. Because in an age of mass consumption and mass communication, uniformity is what raises us up. The future was going to be won, the stars were going to be gained in tiny little 15-cent installments. And I use that particular figure quite advisedly because 15 cents is about what you'd expect to pay for a McDonald's hamburger in 1955, the year in which they established their first franchised restaurant in Illinois. This was a roadside stand, and it was designed in a very, very specific way to catch the attention of motorists as they went by. It was kind of like a lunch counter that was supported on either end by these yellow parabolic arches that had a very, very kind of futuristic appeal. They were very eye-catching, but they also represented a kind of unfinished ellipsis, an incomplete orbit, or if you like, the trajectory of the new intercontinental ballistic missiles, which the Pentagon had just announced they were developing after receiving the word from the RAND Corporation the previous year that missiles and with nuclear warheads was definitely the way to go. So in amongst this uniformity, you have a sense that this is how the nuclear family, pun intended, is going to present itself and how it's going to defend itself too. 1955 is the year in which the Portland Cement Company first advertised their blast-resistant, bomb-proof ranch-style bungalow house, which was going to give you affordable comfort in living, but also the possibility of preserving your family in the case of a nuclear strike. And it's also the year that the Atomic Energy Commission pulls a little stunt in July to promote the fact that the first atomic-generated electricity is going to be made commercially available. What they did was they got a housewife to cook atom burgers right by the site of the nuclear power plant itself. And there's some lovely pictures from the period of a smiling housefrau in an apron flipping a burger in a skillet on an electric stove, with the nuclear core and cooling towers in the distance behind her, dwarfing her little salt and pepper shaker set that she has on her work surface. So you can see the extent that the futuristic and the domestic, the alien and the threatening and the comforting are all coming together in these strange combinations. And there's something indeed comforting about these combinations. 1955 is also the year when David Reisman's The Lonely Cloud, a groundbreaking sociological study of how mass America was reviewing itself. And in it, he has an interview with a little girl who admires Superman. This is in a time when the American Comics Code has come in and superheroes are actually no longer fighting earthbound human criminals in a violent way. They're actually turning more and more towards attacking aliens from outer space because this kind of violence was acceptable within the newly established code. She admires Superman. She wants to fly like Superman, but only if everyone else can fly too, because she feels it would be kind of conspicuous otherwise. So that's our kind of domestic future. That's the new family future. It's one in which the whole family can fly. And so it probably comes as no fantastic surprise to discover that in 1955, July, Disneyland opens its gates for the first time to the public. In fact, in a weird confluence of events, Disneyland opens the day before the Atomic Energy Commission pull their little stunt with the woman atop her electric cooker. Now, this was a great adventure for Disney. It was a great undertaking. He had to sell his own home. He had to sell his own life insurance. He had to mortgage himself up to the hilt in order to realize the dream of this happy place on Earth, the happiest place on Earth, in fact. And it was built on what was formerly an orange grove in Anaheim, California. And even that gesture in itself is actually mirroring the development of the suburbs, which was mostly colonizing former agricultural and rural land throughout America. One of the things that's interesting about Disneyland was that it didn't actually get off to a very good start. In fact, its opening day was known as Black Sunday because of the number of things that went wrong. For example, more visitors arrived than they'd actually originally anticipated, so the food and drinks concessions ran out very, very quickly. A lot of the rides didn't work properly. Worst of all, there were no drinking fountains available on this particularly hot Sunday afternoon. This was the result of a plumber's strike, which meant that there was only enough time to either get the toilets or the drinking fountains fixed for the opening. So I guess Walt made a good call there. More disturbing still was the fact that the asphalt, a prime staple of suburban living, the asphalt hadn't dried and hardened yet. With the result, a lot of women actually started sinking into the tar pits that should have been Main Street. One of the things that helped Disney get Disneyland over was the fact that he'd actually bought himself into television at the same time. He was actually running a weekly anthology slot in primetime called Disneyland, in which programs were made to reflect the different sectors that Disneyland incorporated. And the one we're most interested in is Tomorrowland, because it's hardly surprising to find that families and space aren't too far apart at the moment. And to help him as a scientific consultant for Tomorrowland, he had Werner von Braun, who's been kicking his heels in Huntsville, Alabama, for some time now, with not much to do. I mean, the Air Force and the Navy already had their rocketry and missile programs. And the important thing as far as America was concerned was that Werner von Braun was in America, not Russia. Basically, he was doing what they wanted just by not working for the Soviets. So he threw himself into Tomorrowland. He produced Man in Space for them, which included live-action animation, and another show called Man and the Moon. And it's very interesting to see how well von Braun meshed with his age, to the extent that this is a man who actually had the ear of Adolf Hitler, now having the full and undivided attention of another guy with a moustache. He was later joined that same year with Chesley Bonestell and Willy Ly in the production of a show called Conquest of Space. This was another attempt to create a kind of factual depiction of what the exploration of outer space was actually going to be like. And it was another great example of how these scientific minds were beginning to look more and more towards the domestic hearth, to the family, in order to present the future as being part of that business we call show. Despite being based on a book by Wernher von Braun and also incorporating writings by Chesley Bonestell and advice from Willy Ley, Conquest of Space was a bit of a mess as a movie. Most of the action takes place, or rather it starts on an iron donut, a space station orbiting the Earth, and the astronauts there believe they're building a rocket that's going to take them to the moon. Actually, it's not going to take them to the moon at all. It's going to take them to Mars. Change of plan there, which was left to the last minute, and it leaves the commander of the project just a little confused. In fact, he very quickly goes off his head and has to be killed by his son in transit rather than risk the failure and destruction of the entire mission. So again, we're back with families. More importantly, in Conquest of Space, is the fact that the writers and producers in Hollywood really didn't know what went on inside spaceships. And as a consequence, the crews of our futuristic flying machines, Conquest of Space was actually supposed to be set in the 1980s, tended to look exactly like and behave exactly like the kind of crews you get in U-boats and destroyers and submarines in the kind of World War II melodramas that were still being knocked out at the time. So you begin to wonder why these kind of people would be allowed into space. They tend to be noisy, rude, jocular, and joshing each other, and in the case of father and son, even attempting to kill each other. Maybe we should look somewhere else to see how people in spaceships should behave. Try this, for example. At our work and in our leisure time, we mingle with people here on Earth, never betraying the secret that we are inhabitants of other worlds. That would be dangerous, as you well know. We understand you better, people, than most of you know yourselves, and can plainly see the reasons for the many unhappy conditions that surround you. This statement was made by a man from Saturn, and it occurred during a drive through the outskirts of Los Angeles. Passengers were on their way to a rendezvous with a Venusian scout ship which had just landed in the desert. And if you hadn't guessed by now, yep, George Adamski is back and he's got his second book out. A follow-up to Flying Saucers Have Landed. This one takes the whole thing a stage further and it's called Inside the Spaceships, or as one of its readers once said, the most important book since the Bible. It was published in 1955, and I've got to say, the spaceship stuff's fun. It gives you an idea of how you really should be behaving in a sort of calm and brotherly way in outer space. But it's actually Adamski's encounters with people from Mars and Saturn and Venus, just in like hotel lobbies and in the backs of cars around LA, that actually stick in my mind best. It ends up that they've actually integrated themselves quite well into daily life in the States, even sort of fitting their work patterns in with those of the Earthlings around them. We are permitted to make brief visits to our home planets, the man from Saturn goes on to say. Just as you long for a change of scene or to see old friends, so it is with us. It is necessary, of course, to arrange such absences during official holidays or even over a weekend so that we will not be missed by our associates here on Earth. So, you know, while everyone else has gone to Disneyland, these guys are actually going back to Saturn and Mars to see their folks. The thing that's very, very interesting about Adamski is that the questions he doesn't ask, he's all kinds of things he never asks, he never bothers to find out about. And here's a classic case. I did not ask whether my companions were married and had families here on our planet, but I had the impression that this was not the case. See, we're never very, very far away from the family here. Adamski, after all, was the guy who coined the term mothership to describe the main carriers that would orbit the Earth, sending down their little scout craft. Now, fun as Inside the Spaceships is, it's another book on UFOs that we really should be looking at for 1955. This is a more modest undertaking by an archaeologist and astronomer called Morris K. Jessop, and his book is called The Case for the UFOs. Now, a little like the co-author of Flying Saucers Have Landed, Desmond Leslie, he takes a historical view. He looks at odd, anomalous events in human history and in mythology and relates them to flying saucers and UFO sightings. And this really isn't the right age to do this. This is what happened when Leslie co-authored Flying Saucers Have Landed with Adamski. Leslie's bit tended to be forgotten while Adamski sort of really got people's attention with the Space Brothers. So what we have with Jessop is a very intelligent, sort of well thought out book that comes to the attention of the Office of Naval Intelligence in the summer of 1955 because it has been mailed to them anonymously by someone in Texas. And this edition has gotten annotations on nearly every page, written in different handwritings and different inks, and it becomes apparent that it has been read and critiqued by someone who knows a great deal about propulsion systems and interstellar travel and how flying saucers operate. So intrigued is the Office of Naval Intelligence by this publication that they actually farm it out to a high-tech company called Varro in Texas to actually transcribe and study. And they also inform Jessup of what has happened to his book and that people have been reading it with knowledge of strange new science. Now that in itself is disturbing, and we'll be coming back to Jessup in the remaining shows of this series from time to time to see how he's getting on. But let us say at this point, he's extremely disturbed. Weirder still is the fact that in 1955, a film comes out called This Island Earth, in which a scientist becomes increasingly disturbed by a book that appears to have been written by intelligences from another planet. This particular scientist works for a company like Varro. It's a high-tech company that's doing government research into nuclear power. And he's a swinging scientist, Cal Meacham. We've not seen a guy like this yet. He has his own private Lockheed jet. He has meetings with the president in the White House. And he is building his own little atomic reactor in California. He gets intrigued by this catalogue. He sends off the parts in it. And soon he's able to build what is known as an interocitor. This book is filled with stuff about the interocitor. His assistant, Joe, at one point says, here's something my wife could use in her house, an interocitor incorporating an electron sorter. Ha, says Cal Meacham, forgetting that he's actually creating this energy to go into push-button gadgets. She probably gained 20 pounds while it did all the housework for her. How's that for futuristic thinking? Anyway, they build their interocitor, and now I think one of the greatest moments in 50s sci-fi movie dumb takes place. They built the interocitor. Joe says, what do we do now? Cal Meacham, ever the scientist, says, plug it in, Joe. Let's see what happens. The notion that the entire universe is actually wired up to the American power grid is one which I still think we need to study today. It's a remarkable moment. And it has remarkable consequences. Pretty soon, he's jetting off to Metaluna in the company of our great friend Faith Domergue, who is playing another nuclear scientist. And they're off to save the planet Metaluna, having briefly met at a little sort of ranch-style scientific commune being set up by aliens in a model that's remarkably similar to the Rand Corporation. Can they save Metaluna? I don't know. I think we're going to have to find out after the break.
Happy place, welcome. Disneyland is your land. Here age relives fond memories of the past. And here youth may savor the challenge and promise of the future. Disneyland is dedicated to the ideals, the dreams, and the hard facts that have created America, with the hope that it will be a source of joy and inspiration to all the world. Thank you.
Yes, Metaluna. It's a kind of symbol of all that's gone wrong with the universe. Everything that doesn't happen in a George Adamski book is happening there. There is no peace in outer space, ladies and gentlemen. Metaluna is in war with those nut bars on Zagon who are currently pummeling it to pieces with meteorites. Can Cal Meacham and Ruth Adams, played by beautiful Faith Domergue, save them? Well, no. Basically, this is a cosmic road movie that just keeps on moving forwards, and it ends, in a sense, for real, on the planet Metaluna, just about to go nova. The reason they're on Metaluna is to encounter one of these beings that's becoming increasingly of interest to us in this series. It's called a mutant. It's a large, kind of overdeveloped insect with its brain on the outside of its head, and it's bred for the purposes of being a slave to the people of Metaluna. So once again, we're in this kind of strange chain of being that connects upper with the lower, the higher being with the less developed. And in fact, 1955 was a good year for this kind of movie. Faith Domergue herself also appeared in a film called Cult of the Cobra that year, in which she turned into a giant snake. And here's just a little rundown of some of the other kind of apocalyptic science beast movies that you could have seen that year. Creature with the Atom Brain, Devil Girl from Mars, Revenge of the Creature, The Beast with a Million Eyes, The Day the World Ended, World Without End, Hey boys, make your minds up, will you? King Dinosaur and Tarantula, a film about a tarantula so big that it has to be shot down with by Air Force jets. But it's the mutant of Metaluna that I think stands above them all, a kind of strange evolutionary reject. But what's with that brain on the outside of its head? Well, you know, this is actually a great year for thinking about the mind, and also about science's role in the development and exploration of the mind. And perhaps it's worth thinking at the moment, bearing this in mind before we go a step further, that 1955 is the year when Robert Oppenheimer, former chair of the Atomic Energy Commission and the father of the atomic bomb, Big Daddy at Los Alamos himself, finally fesses up and says in his most personal revelation, in a very profound sense, and in a way that cannot be lightly dismissed, we scientists have sinned. And there are a lot of sinners and saints in 1955. Donald Hebb, who you may remember from a few years back carrying out sensory deprivation experiments with his students up in Canada and fostering them an interest in occult matters, has just referred and briefed a couple of guys to the CIA. And here we have saint and sinner sharing the same corridor almost at the National Institutes of Health in Washington. See if you can tell the difference between them. One is John C. Lilly, who's been experimenting with monkeys in which they are able to stimulate their pleasure centers through electrodes that have been implanted in their brains. He actually got so disturbed by this kind of research that he finally started to experiment on himself in a giant sensory deprivation isolation tank in which he floated in lukewarm saline solution in a darkened room. And he was quite content to carry on experimenting in this way. When the CIA approached him, he was not prepared to work with them because he didn't like the idea of his findings being kept a secret. Besides, there was only so much damage you can do with an isolation tank. The CIA had a much more enthusiastic response from one Dr. Maitland Baldwin, a former student of Hepp's, and who'd also studied with Wilder Penfield up in Canada. Baldwin is the kind of stuff nightmares are made of. He experimented too with apes, but he was actually transplanting their brains. He was also lobotomizing them and sticking them in a sensory deprivation box of his own design. What he was interested in doing, and why he was very glad that the CIA happened to knock on his door, was he wanted to develop this box to the point where it could be used to termination with a particular subject, and actually he rather favored what he called an antagonistic subject, someone who would actually be resistant to being cut off from all sensory input. He did warn, though, about his little experiment that it's possible that when they recovered from the experiment, they may notice a certain diminution in their mental capacities. This, I think, is a remarkable moment in the history of covert science because Maitland Baldwin had actually just proposed a project that even the CIA gagged on. This is part of a memo that was attached to the report. I don't know who the author is, but I like his tone. Does the project officer, he writes, approve of these immoral and inhuman tests? I suggest that all who are in favor of the above-mentioned operation volunteer their heads for use in Dr. Baldwin's noble project. Yep, we really are with the creature with the atom brain here. But we should also bear in mind that there are other strange currents coming into play, and I'd like to draw your attention to the largely up to this point unsung activities of a man called Al Hubbard. Hubbard would have to be created by history in order for history to realize itself, so remarkable is this man. He's an ex-OSS officer. The OSS, you remember, was the precursor to the CIA, who had made a small personal fortune dealing with uranium. He actually was running the Vancouver Uranium Core at the time, and he was channeling his resources into the propagation of LSD as a spiritual tool, as a means of enlightening the human spirit. It's also interesting to note that Al Hubbard, as a boy, claims to have invented a perpetual motion device and to have created a form of radar following notes left by Nikola Tesla. So you can see which end of the playing field this guy's running around. And, you know, it's encouraging to have him with us. It was Hubbard, after all, in December of 1955, who gave Aldous Huxley his first shot of LSD and who suggested to Huxley that the thing that was interesting about LSD was that, yes, it did break the mind apart, but it allowed you to reconstruct it around much more spiritual religious lines, that it was possible to influence the mind in a positive way through music, through pictures, etc. And it's a kind of trajectory of experimentation that we'll find people like Huxley and Lilly themselves both following in the years to come. how very, very different this is from the kind of standard institutionalized experiments that were going on at this time. In an age when really LSD was still seen as kind of madness in a capsule, this was still the age of the laboratory madness boys who still saw it as being a means of possibly taking a mind apart but not quite putting it back together again properly. Still the point where, you know, LSD is the dynamite that the CIA is hoping it's going to be. It's still a weapon. So to have someone to suggest that it would have this more nurturing effect on its taker is encouraging, to say the least, particularly when a magazine in Canada in October of 1955 ran a story called Canadian Scientists Develop Beneficial Brainwashing. This was an early publication of some of Ewan Cameron's findings at the Allen Memorial Hospital. He's been working on a technique of using tape recordings of patients' sessions with a psychiatrist mixed with messages that enforce a particularly positive message, which is played back to them while they're in a state of chemically induced sleep. Now, Cameron has actually bypassed any kind of peer review at this point. Mark you, if it's the laboratory madness people, maybe that's a pretty wise strategy. And he, like our boys Wernher von Braun, like Willie Lai, like Chesley Beiersdorf, has gone straight to the people with this article about how he's trying to use these kind of brainwashing techniques to cure patients. And here's just a little quote from the article, just to give you the kind of feel of what he's doing. The doctors at the Allen are, of course, doing the exact opposite of mental murder. They are making sick minds well again, but they face many of the same problems as the professional brainwashers. Prisoners of war resist attempts to indoctrinate them, and almost every patient tries to defend himself against the unpleasant impact of his own recorded voice by deliberately not listening to it or by thinking of something else. Well, Ewan Cameron was taking care of the problem of trying to think of something else. People that were using this taped experimental procedure were usually in a chemically induced coma that could last anything up to 40 or 50 hours at a time. Any resistance to the taped message would result in a continuation of the coma. And a little like the CIA, Cameron was quite prepared to use any technique at his disposal. That included LSD, insulin, adrenaline shots, speed, barbiturates, anything that might possibly work. And it's kind of nice, I think, to end this particular review of this particular year with a little film that you don't get to see very often these days, a very ripe little medical melodrama called The Cobweb, which was released by MGM, and it was set within the confines of a mental hospital in which the patients and the doctors are in some kind of intense relationship over what colour drapes there are going to be in the institution's library. The doctors are so intent on looking after their patients that they're actually neglecting that very, very important item in 1955, their own family. And in fact, one of the doctors is berated by his wife, who says, "Yesterday in school, they asked Rosie what she wanted to be when she grew up. Like to know what she answered? A patient."
Welcome to Mars was conceived and presented by Ken Hollings. Electronic sound production and studio engineering were by Simon James. This live studio presentation has been a Project Thrust production. Project Thrust, the name you can trust. On next week's Welcome to Mars, weird radio signals from Venus, psychic driving, and America's first atomic-powered singer. Want to find out more? Well, you'll just have to wait until Programme 9 in our series, 1956. Greetings, my friends. Same time, same place. Bring a doctor.